I'd like to begin by extending my thanks to Dr. Moeller and Dr. Moore for inviting me to your beautiful and renowned seminary for the purpose of delivering three lectures around the topic of secularism. I am also grateful to the donors who made these endowed lectures, the Gean's lectures, possible through their gifts. Occasions like these are part of what make life in the Academy uniquely enjoyable. Now, oddly enough, I'll have to start by talking a little bit about Twitter. I know, Twitter at a formal lecture, that seems wrong. I'm a fan of Twitter. I do my share of reading updates from friends and putting my own brief reflections out there for others to examine. But I don't think that I can come close to the culture of Twitter that appears to exist among the leadership of this seminary. And, of course, some of the students, too. I follow Robbie Sagers and Philip Bethencourt. I tried to respond to a direct message from Philip Bethencourt, and I was not allowed to because it told me Philip Bethencourt is not following you on Twitter. So I've already been rejected. Robbie does. I was recently a panel speaker at the Values Voters Summit put on by the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. And as I sat in one of the sessions, a presentation by a Christian entertainment executive, I believe this gentleman was the inventor of GodTube, and they call us derivative. They say we copy things. Dr. Russell Moore, during this man's presentation, Dr. Russell Moore sat down next to me. And the entire time the creator of this new channel was speaking, Dr. Moore had two devices in his hand, and he was just madly typing away, you know, the entire time this gentleman is speaking. And I felt pity for Dr. Moore because I assumed that the demands of his seminary work and his speaking schedule were so great that the poor man was unable to sit back and listen to a presentation without simultaneously just processing a load of email and taking care of his to-do list. After I returned to my hotel room, I logged on to Twitter at my laptop. And to my surprise, I discovered a running commentary by Dr. Moore on the presentation he'd heard downstairs. It turned out that Dr. Moore was, shall we say, skeptical about the new network's plan to reach the youth demographic. They had a bang-up idea to reach the youth with a drama starring Robert Shuler, the famous founder of the Crystal Cathedral and the Hour of Power. So you can find a lot of interesting things on Twitter, packaged in pithy statements of no more than 140 characters. The idea for the title of this lecture came from something I read on Twitter a couple of months ago. Some of you may recall that in the aftermath of the recent election in Iran, a number of protesters claimed that the government tampered with the results to stay in power. Twitter was a key channel these students used to express their outrage and to receive support from sympathetic Westerners, many of whom shaded their profile pictures green as kind of a sign of solidarity with the Iranian students. And I was very curious about this. I happened upon a number of short statements from students in Iran, and they were all asking for the same thing. And here's what it looked like, you know, in capital letters. They said, "We want freedom, democracy, and secularism." Freedom, democracy, and secularism. I found this three-word formulation somewhat surprising. Having studied the history of the West and having paid particular attention to the question of religion and politics, this combination of concepts struck me as an odd one. But it obviously resonates with some of the Iranian students who repeatedly use the internet to call for this particular combination of political ideals, freedom, democracy, and secularism. I find it again and again. They seem to believe it is the formula. And so those earnest students, trapped in a Muslim, theocratic Iranian system, have identified the path that they believe is necessary for a better life in their country. And they have given me the title of my lecture for today. But in my case, I encountered their slogan more as a question rather than as an assertion. Freedom, democracy, and secularism? Do they really belong together? Is there a natural association there? What the students in Iran are looking for is a new revolution. They're unsatisfied with what they have. They don't like the results of the earlier revolution that took place in the 1970s. That revolution produced the current theocratic regime by overthrowing, ironically enough, a secular nationalist dictator, the Shah of Iran, and replacing his rule with that of the Muslim clerics. Of course, the Shah, though a secular ruler, did not have a great appreciation for democracy and freedom. This fact alone should give the students pause in their automatic association of secularism with freedom and democracy. There really is nothing inherent in the nature of secularism that would correspond to freedom or democracy. Secularism simply means that religious values and ideas are considered extraneous to public life. Secularism may produce freedom from religion, that much is clear, but not necessarily political freedom. It just doesn't follow. The clerics did not like the secular Shah because he diminished their influence and presided over a more culturally relaxed moral climate. He was primarily interested in governing in such a way that reinforced his own power rather than protecting any notion of rights and freedoms of his people. He was also basically friendly to the West. He calculated that he was better off with the U.S. than with the Soviet Union. He governed based on his interest, which is a thoroughly secular thing to do. After all, promoting one's own power and advancement is worldly. And worldly, by the way, is not a bad synonym for secular. The theocratic regime, despite the early hopes of Western liberals back in the 70s, has not turned out to be better than the Shah's. Neither regime is good for the people or for their rights. I'm willing to agree that Iran perhaps could use another revolution. The current regime is irrationally bent on the destruction of Israel, has pushed hard to develop offensive nuclear capabilities, and is, in many ways, oppressive. Perhaps a new revolution, another try, might produce a happier result. But the question is, what kind of revolution? What sort of models should we consider, particularly if we are thinking in terms of freedom, democracy, and secularism? If I had the opportunity to speak with these Iranian students yearning for a better government, I would urge them to consider the two most consequential revolutions of the last 300 years as a way of testing the soundness of their assumption. Those would be the American and French revolutions, which happened almost contemporaneously near the close of the 18th century. Other than an epical event like the birth of Christ, it would be difficult to find historic occurrences that continue to shape the world in which we live more than these two have. The Chinese premier, sort of the more reasonable wingman of Chairman Mao, in the mid to late 20th century, Zhou Enlai, was supposedly once asked for his opinion of the French Revolution. According to the story, he thought for a moment and said, "Too soon to tell." If the story is true, the assessment was correct. The French Revolution continues to have an effect on our history. What was started then impacts us now in our own time. The French revolutionaries, in their hubris, set out to remake the world with a brand new calendar, which would replace the old Christian division of history. Their calendar would begin with the year one, thus signifying the importance they attached to their own acts and ideas. Not so long ago, another group of revolutionaries in Cambodia, under the dictator Pol Pot, declared the year zero. thinking his own efforts to be worthy of a new beginning of human history. Both of those revolutions, the French one and the Cambodian one, and others we'll talk about, proved exceptionally bloody. Political murder, in both cases, was the primary method of achieving fundamental agreement. Sometimes it is the incrementalism of historic events that sows the seeds of social change. Kings occasionally needed money for wars or other major undertaking, and that's part of how England's Parliament developed, for example. Occasionally they would be called in to hear of the king's need for revenue, and they were supposed to go back home and return with the needed resources. From that point, what seemed like a very limited and highly controllable state of affairs, something comfortable for a king, they began to lose influence to these representatives they would call in, because it was only a matter of time before these assemblies regularly called, would begin to feel their own force and demand input in exchange for their support. So it was in France. Louis XVI called in the Estates General, representing the three estates of the nobility, the clergy, and the people, to help resolve a financial crisis. All voting was done by estates rather than by heads. And so what would happen is the nobility and the clergy, most of whom were also nobility, would vote together against the estate of the people. So it wasn't exactly fair. The vote of the third estate, the people, was basically irrelevant because it was one vote against the other two. And they saw the church as sort of an engine of oppression. A powerful pamphlet of the time stirred the people by proclaiming, "What is the third estate? Everything. What has it been until now in the political order? Nothing. What does it want to be? Something." These democratic sentiments drove the beginning of the French Revolution. What was supposed to be a simple exercise in collecting greater revenue to support the king's activities blossomed into extreme political unrest and then full-on revolution. So, at least at the beginning, let's stipulate that there was some justice in what the French revolutionaries set out to accomplish. The common people, a term I mean to include merchants and artisans as well as peasants, were tired of bearing heavy financial burdens, doing most of the productive work in the society, and having no real say in the government of the French state. And it was clear that their plight was at least partially due to the overly friendly relationship between the nobility and high-level clergy, who were, in most cases, nobles. The top layers of the Catholic clergy lived a life of privilege and did not seem terribly interested in the well-being of the people. This, by the way, is not intended as any kind of attack on the Catholic Church, which I tend to view as a highly admirable institution, nor even on the whole of the Catholic Church in the period. I'm simply telling the story that was true at the time. It was said of the clergy that they administered more provinces than sacraments. So as I say, there was some justice in the anger and the unrest that led to the revolution. The people saw a church more interested in preserving its own power and prerogatives and supporting the status quo than in either calling the state to righteousness or engaging in serious ministry of any kind. And France had an intellectual elite with a clear anti-Christian agenda. The famed Voltaire loved to provoke with his criticisms and mockery of the Christian view of God. Not quite as famously, Voltaire was always careful to close the doors when he was having these discussions with his friends, because he didn't want his servants to hear and then perhaps feel that they should steal his silver. He and Rousseau, another proclaimer of the pernicious influence of Christianity, both died in the period shortly before the revolution occurred. Rousseau felt the Christian church introduced a second master, which would confuse the loyalties of the citizens. Instead, he believed their hearts and minds would better be aligned directly with the general will of the people in the form of the state. the Frenchman Denis Diderot, mastermind of a huge encyclopedia that he hoped would liberate the minds of men, is often said to have proclaimed his desire, this should give you a shudder here at the seminary, his desire to see the last king strangled with the guts of the last priest. And so, this was a revolution designed not merely to overturn the throne, but also to break the power of the altar. In relatively short order, the leaders of the revolution embarked upon a campaign of explicit de-Christianization to remove the church from the society, though at first they had begun to try to gain control of the Catholic clergy. They moved more boldly to create an entirely new culture. The cathedral at Notre Dame became the Temple of Reason. Over 1,400 streets were renamed to remove not only the names of monarchs, but also of Christian saints and reminders of the Christian faith. Going further, the new republic established a civil cult around the notion of worship of the supreme being. This concept was extraordinarily broad, and it fit well with Rousseau's notion of the general will. The new state called upon artists and writers to come up with new ways to celebrate special occasions in line with the new civil cult. In our own world, this past process of the French Revolution reminds me a little bit of the invention of Kwanzaa, a holiday invented by a college professor in African studies. In essence, what is happening with something like the cult of the supreme being is that the nation worships its own collective self and its own values. In the beginning, they had great hopes for this revolution, this total remaking of the society. But in the heady rush of making the world new, thanks to the power of unfettered human reason, something went terribly, terribly wrong. Mark Knoll captured it well when he wrote, "Escape from deference, traditions, and the rule of hereditary elites led to new sources of oppression rather than a flowering of liberty. Indiscriminate violence orchestrated by new rulers mocked their visions of equality. The leaders first executed hundreds and then many thousands suspected of lacking the proper revolutionary frame of mind. Their actions foreshadowed the new totalitarian states of the 20th century, which liquidated millions of human beings for failure to unquestioningly follow grand visions with new ideas about human life and the destiny of states." Now let me stop and draw a line right there. I've referenced the murderous results of the secular revolution carried out in France and of other secular revolutions that followed in the last century. At this point, think about how often Christianity has been accused of being a killer faith, as critics take pains to highlight the Inquisition, for instance, which was also a form of ideological and spiritual conformity enforced by physical punishment and occasionally executions. Just to add a little perspective to these reflections, I'd like to invoke Richard John Neuhaus, who accurately noted that those who believe the record of the secular Enlightenment is spotless compared to that of the Church are essentially in denial. To quote Neuhaus, "Those who tell the story this way overlook the fact that in 300 years, the Inquisition had fewer victims than were killed any given afternoon during the years of Stalin's purges and Hitler's concentration camps." He could easily have added Mao's violent cultural revolution, which encouraged and empowered crazed teenagers to beat senior citizens with belt buckles if they showed signs of lacking sufficient zeal, they couldn't produce their little red book, or they didn't have a portrait of Mao prominently displayed. The story of the French Revolution was very much the same. The loss of life, not in any war, but in furtherance of the domestic ideological ambitions of a state, far outstripped any deaths caused by the Inquisition. The rulers of the New France were men like Robespierre and the infamous and ironically named Committee of Public Safety. It was they who preceded the Nazis of the 20th century in justifying their actions out of love for the fatherland. The revolution met the end that radical utopian efforts often do. Robespierre himself died when the guillotine separated his head from his body. France fell into crisis and disorder, which had to be resolved. As so often happens, a strong man stepped in. Today we have Putin in Russia. Then it was Napoleon. Napoleon became the absolute ruler of France and proceeded to bring war and death like a plague to much of Europe. The ultimate fruit of the revolution was an unstable France that did not become a stable constitutional republic until years after the Second World War, when General de Gaulle was able to name his conditions for taking power and forming a workable government. So we have briefly considered the French Revolution, a secularizing revolution, a revolution which sought to wipe out what had gone before and to remake the world in the name of human reason, free from the chains of either monarchical command or what they viewed as religious enslavement. The result was similar to letting a 12-year-old drive the car on a busy interstate after he has loudly criticized his parents for the past 2 hours. Shaky, risky, and in this case, fatally dangerous. The once hopeful social movement ended in dictatorship. Based on the French Revolution and revolutions that to some degree followed in its footsteps, the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Communist Revolution, Pol Pot's revolution in Cambodia, Castro's revolution in Cuba, all fully secular, I would say that the case for naturally associating freedom, democracy, and secularism is not very good. So I've used the French Revolution and some historic events which I think follow in its wake to argue against putting freedom, democracy, and secularism together. But can I make a case that freedom and democracy go with something other than secularism? Can I make a case that Christianity bears some responsibility for fostering freedom and democracy in the world? I think I can, which is why I'd like to spend some time focusing on the American Revolution, which is different from its European counterpart in a number of ways. The differences are made more striking by the closeness in time of the two revolutions. The American Revolution was different in part because the American church situation was so different from anything in Europe. The European church situation, very different from that in America. In France, the Catholic Church had maintained power despite the Reformation. But even in the European countries where the Reformation prevailed, the church tended to align itself with the monarchs, if for no other reason for protection from Rome, which at the time was willing to fight and persecute for what it considered to be its rights. Crowned heads often welcomed the Reformation. Their motives varied. Some favored the birth of Protestantism because of their own legitimate Christian piety. But others embraced it because the Reformation had the effect of reducing the power of the papacy and enhancing their own independence as rulers. Unfortunately, that result of the Reformation was not a happy one, as it led to the growth of absolutism in Europe, as leaders were less often checked by the church. Ultimately, each nation in Europe chose a national church and established it legally, sometimes Catholic, sometimes Protestant. The American situation did not fit the traditional pattern of one nation, one king, one religion. It might be illustrative to tell a story from when I was a graduate student at the University of Georgia a number of years ago. One of my fellow students was a British punk rock sort of a fellow with an honest-to-goodness mohawk and goatee. The goatee's not so weird now, but at the time it was. And when he found out that I was a Christian, probably by looking at some provocative T-shirt I was wearing, he explained to me that England is perfect. And he wondered if I wanted to know why. Well, of course, I did want to know. England is perfect. You know, I tried this with an accent at home, but I just can't pull it off. England is perfect, he said, smiling, because we shipped all our criminals out to Australia, and our religious fanatics, that's how he put it, fanatics, our religious fanatics to America. We shared a good laugh over that, but the sentiment regarding American religion has some historical precedent. Many thinkers, mostly European, but also some early American, believed that a church established by the state, like the English church, is the civilized way to go because it keeps religious enthusiasm in check. Look at Rodney Stark's work on church establishment. He has, in my mind, proven that legally establishing the church kills the church, that it kills the dynamism of the church, that it kills attendance and membership. For that matter, Karl Marx liked church establishment. He loved to joke that the Church of England would give up 38 of its 39 articles before it gave up 1/39th of its income. But back to those religious fanatics. We all know the story of the religious dissenters, the Puritans, who came to the wild frontier in America to worship in their own way. We think of them as promoters of religious liberty, and that is a misperception. They wanted to set up a church with the doctrines they believed were right, and then they wanted to enforce adherence to those doctrines. Their church was intended for everyone in the community. Those who disagreed, like Roger Williams, for example, were forced out of the fellowship, both spiritually and politically. In early America, the original design was in favor of a legal relationship between the church and state, but religious freedom did not come to America because the Puritans desired to be free, nor did it come because intellectuals like Thomas Jefferson just dreamed it up. It would be more accurate to say that conditions on the ground brought religious liberty to America, perhaps providentially. The combination of the reality of frontier life, vast geographic spaces lightly populated, the remoteness of European religious sponsors and authorities, and the simple fact of religious pluralism led to religious liberty in America. Certainly, there were various church establishments, as with the Congregationalists and the Episcopalians, but they were far less imposing than the original European affairs, and they coexisted with other colonies and later states which openly embraced religious toleration of a variety of confessions. Some varieties of American Christians pushed for religious freedom as a matter of their understanding of the faith itself. They saw the state as a merely instrumental and temporal authority with no right to legal power over religious observance. That right, they felt, is God's alone. One of the greatest contributions of the Baptist faith, for instance, was its insistence that the regenerate church is superior to the comprehensive church. In other words, the Baptists believed participation in the church should be voluntary and not a community-mandated enterprise. In addition to the unique landscape of American Christianity due to religious pluralism and increasing toleration, there was also the gigantic impact of the Great Awakening of the early 18th century. Pre-Revolutionary War America was post-Great Awakening America. This is one of the reasons it is strange to hear some writers claim that the America of the founding was largely irreligious. You have these writers, you know, putting out things like the Godless Institution, that for some reason, right around 1776 and thereabout, everybody was an agnostic. The Awakening, sparked by the sensation of the public preaching of George Whitefield, among others, caused the largest community gatherings in colonial history. While I would not go so far as to claim that there is some kind of direct and immediate causation between the Awakening and the American Revolution, I think it is clear that the Awakening helped change American Christianity. Instead of the old pattern of a highly educated clergy formalistically conveying the faith to a deferential flock, American religion began to be dominated by a new sense of direct experience between God and the individual believer, foreshadowing the later massive success, and there's no other way to characterize it, massive success of Baptists and Methodists in the 19th century, earnest sincerity, enthusiasm, personal empowerment, and energetic commitment began to be the hallmarks of the faith in America. By the time of the American Revolution, the vigor of Christianity did not really depend on legal reinforcement for its place in the hearts and minds of Americans. The church had a degree of independence simply not seen on the continent across the ocean. And the willingness of Americans to challenge ancient and/or foreign authority was at that time quite great. When American colonists began to feel alarmed at English laws, which seemed to overreach into the affairs of people accustomed to governing themselves, and to do so without offering them any representation in the process, the American church joined the popular protest movement. The New England clergy, if anything, may have been too enthusiastic about challenging the British. Unlike the French Catholic Church, the American church was a major force in the Revolution rather than a target of it. The American Revolution did not have the secularizing agenda of the French one. Certainly, the two revolutions were similar in their distaste for monarchy and power exercised in an arbitrary fashion without regard to the natural rights of citizens. But in almost all other respects, the two revolutions were worlds apart. Clearly, they differed on the matter of secularization. Equally clearly, they had hugely different results. One revolution led to dictatorship, the other led to the expansion of freedom and democracy. So far, I've sought to demonstrate how different the religious pluralism and voluntary Christianity of America was to the Catholicism of France, which was intertwined with the throne to the point of being an object of the revolutionary scorn. While the French revolutionaries de-Christianized their nation, the same idea, considered in the context of American society during the same period, would have been ridiculous. By and large, the American church was firmly ensconced within the popular movement of the people. Yet, contrary to the assumption of the Iranian student that freedom, democracy, and secularism go together, it was the much more Christian American Revolution that led to the creation of the longest-running and most stable constitutional republic in the world. But in examining the broader question of whether freedom, democracy, and secularism naturally go together, there is more to say than that the French Revolution was secularizing in intent, but did not result in freedom and democracy, and that the American Revolution was not secularizing and did result in the expansion of freedom and democracy. To say that much would be simply to observe covariation, things that happen together. In other words, I would be able to say that freedom, democracy, and Christianity traveled together in the American Revolution, while freedom, democracy, and secularism failed to travel together in the French one. So far, I have some evidence, not necessarily causation, but some evidence. The occurrence of two or three things together is powerful. For example, when lightning hits nearby, within a short time, we hear what? Thunder. We might begin to suppose that the strike of the lightning is the cause of the thunder. So I propose to think a little more about the relationship of Christianity to freedom and democracy. The most basic question in politics has to do with power. In the ancient world, indeed in the modern world, many political rulers exercised power as though given carte blanche by God, or invested directly with his substance. That can be seen in the Roman emperors, who were worshipped as gods, and also with various Asian emperors, even of more recent vintage, who were supposedly divine. These nations and peoples embraced their own Hobbesian leviathans, hoping for peace and order. In the French Revolution, the battle was also over who had the power. The revolutionaries forcibly took power from the king and the nobles and gave it, at least in name, to the people. In reality, the power was held by men like Robespierre and the Committee of Public Safety. But the question is there. Who has the power? Who has the power? Of course, power held in the name of people is often the most dangerous of all. The use of such power can often be a cynical and oppressive exercise, benefiting from the illusion of moral authority. We rule in the name of the people. The notorious dictator Castro, of course, also ruled in the name of the people. It doesn't mean they had a say in any of it. Castro, by the way, also a completely secular ruler, just to kind of pound in the nails of my point. Not much freedom and democracy to accompany his secularism. In any case, the French Revolution aimed to take the power away from an elite and to give it to the people, who would then all gladly bow to this general will. Because the Christian church might clash with the general will and set up a conflict in the individual citizen's mind, well, then better to leave the church out of the society. This, by the way, is secularism at its core. Religious convictions interfere with the operation of a state empowered to enforce the general will. Religion can be, in fact, a check on state power, one that is often freedom-enhancing, especially if that religion is Christianity. The special genius of the American Revolution and of the American founding was to see that while it was important to be right about the question of who wields the power, there's another question that is equally important and maybe even more important. And that question is, how much power? How much power is available to the state? The American Revolution was a response to a perceived abuse of power, and the American founding revolved around limiting power so that it would be more difficult to abuse. Now, why might they have been concerned about that? Now, with all that has been detailed here about the organic relationship between Christianity and America, what impact might the faith have had on a revolution that did produce freedom and democracy? So let's begin with a look at who the Puritans were. The Puritans were Calvinists, certainly powerful shapers of the American mind. A story that I think is often missed when we think about early America is just how powerfully Calvinist it is in nature. One of the hallmarks of Calvinism, of course, is its emphasis on the fallen nature of human beings. This doctrine punctures personal pride and helps to foster a tremendous suspicion of power in human hands. In human hands, and rulers are no different than other human beings. They are fallen. Original sin and human fallenness are doctrines which naturally support the ideas of limited government and constitutionalism. One might also think of the church father Augustine in this connection. He is often tied to Calvin to the point that some Calvinists have at times called themselves Augustinians because he saw sinful pride as the source of men ruling over other men. And because of his acute awareness of the self-serving nature of human beings, Augustine had a dark view of the state. Without Christ, it could not truly know justice. The state might be no better than the largest and most well-equipped band of robbers lining their own pockets with the fruit of oppression and tyranny. Seals of state and uniforms don't necessarily make things different. The United States Constitution, more than any other, is an acknowledgement of the problem of original sin. Power is checked, limited, and balanced to the point that you could describe our government as an engine with sand in the gears. It purposefully clashes and grinds. You wonder why our government can't do anything. It's meant not to be able to do anything. You can see how even when the president has an enormous advantage in Congress, he has a hard time pushing his agenda through. The difficulty is part of the design. You can see the spirit of American Christianity in that design. You can see Calvinism in it. You can see the skepticism toward power in the hands of a temporal state. More generally, consider the Christian idea of man being created in the image of God. such a person is a good prospect to be the holder of inalienable rights. Christian anthropology lends credence to a view of man as having a certain dignity not subject to the whim of governments. Neither kings nor a population wielding the general will should be capable of disturbing his essential rights and liberties. The notion of persons as bearers of the image of God also provides a basis for human equality, and equality supports democracy. The Bible itself also played a role in fostering democracy in the West, and certainly in America. As I make that claim, I'm aware that there are Christian scholars who will say, how do you get that the Bible somehow helps us to achieve democracy? All I see is monarchy there. And if you're talking about kind of what we see in the text, well, sure, yeah, there's a lot of kings in the Bible. I agree with that. But I think that he infers too much from biblical references to monarchs. The Bible speaks of kings, I believe, because that's the dominant form of political authority at the time. I don't think Christians have looked at mentions of kings in the Bible and have felt that they ought to be agitating to save monarchy around the globe. If there's a movement to do that, I've missed it. The only king that we really care to see established upon a throne is Jesus Christ. I'm thinking more broadly than pulling out an example of a king in the Bible to support my contention that the Bible helped to bring democracy to the world. Consider the Bible as a cultural force. Since the time of the Reformation, the biblical text has been widely available in the vernacular of civilized peoples. It has long been viewed by readers as a source both of the revelation of God's plan and of general teaching on right and wrong. For political purposes, you could say that it offers the community equivalent of an objective standard of right and wrong. In the wake of the Bible's wide availability and the Reformers' drive for literacy among the people, that's an underreported project, by the way. The Reformers really pushed literacy in Europe. It became popular to say that a plowboy with scripture on his side could challenge a king. This, too, had a democratizing effect. Two people, be they plowboy or king, stood equal before the word of God. Social or legal position could not decide a dispute where the Bible spoke clearly. As we begin to put some of these ideas together, you have a pretty strong foundation, and more important, a foundation widely accepted by the people for freedom. The kind of freedom that arises from limited government, constitutionalism, and inherent rights and liberties. And, of course, democracy. Perhaps the Iranian students should consider whether they might find a more lasting solution to their troubles in freedom, democracy, and Christianity. Now, to be fair, I would be remiss if I left you with the impression that the Christian faith is the sole source of some of these critical features of the American brand of democracy and ordered liberty. It is not. Another major inspiration for the American founding was the Roman Republic. There, too, one could find things like checks and balances, a degree of democracy, and the separation of powers. It is a fault of some scholars that they want to give all the credit to classical sources, referring to the Greco-Roman world, rather than to Christian ones. So I won't make the same mistake in reverse. It is worth noting, though, that the Roman Republic did not last. It succumbed really rather quickly to the worldly logic of power and dictatorship. It would be better and more accurate to say that our enduring and successful constitutional republic was founded by Americans drawing from both sources. I believe you can effectively derive support for freedom and democracy from the Christian tradition without reference to Greco-Roman precedents. But it would be wrong to suggest that our Constitution was inspired in that way. The American founding was truly a fusion of Christian and classical sources. Happily, the Christian influence successfully modifies some of the worst elements of the classical tradition, such as a deficit of virtues such as humility, mercy, and compassion. What I do think is incontestable is that the strong Christian influence came simply from citizens living in an American culture thoroughly permeated by the Bible and by the church in various manifestations. At the popular level, there was no contest. The Christian faith was the greater influence by far. So, we have reached the point of conclusion. I've used the example of the French Revolution to show that the most infamous, irreligious, and secularizing revolution produced terror and dictatorship. I have also reminded listeners that the French Revolution has been duplicated. It's not a matter of trying it once and then learning the lesson. It's been duplicated many times by other secularizing revolutions, such as those in Russia, China, Cuba, and Cambodia, all of which produced terror and dictatorship. At the same time, I have pointed to the American Revolution, which did not attempt to secularize the society, but in fact drew upon Christian ideas and was widely supported by Christians. That revolution, the more modest one, even though it required taking on the greatest power in the world, resulted in freedom and democracy and produced the nation which in the 20th century would become the greatest and most desperately needed champion of those ideals on the face of the earth. I offered reasons for why and how Christianity and the Bible helped create the intellectual and cultural conditions for the spread of freedom and democracy. The Christian view of man promotes those things which the Iranian student wants, while the Muslim view of man, with which he is more familiar, does not. And I think that is why young Iranians are calling for secularism. It is not because there is any great evidence that secularism is productive of freedom and democracy. Instead, it is because the only way they can envision getting there is if they pretend their faith doesn't matter. This is what secularism encourages us to do. My friend Luis Marcos, who is a wonderful scholar of the humanities, read my earlier thoughts on this matter and summed things up in the following way. In the Muslim world, the church is the state. In the French Revolution, and in those other revolutions to which I referred, the state is the church. It takes over the functioning of the church's roles. In other words, the state generates moral values on its own and then enforces them. In the early history of the American Republic, the founders and the people managed to thread history's needle, providentially, I suppose, and arrived at an almost ideal separation of church and state. For this arrangement, I think a great deal of credit must go to Martin Luther, who correctly understood that the church must not rule souls by steel, and to the Baptists who insisted on voluntary participation in the church. But this separation does not mean that the church withdraws from the life of the society. No, instead, the church in America has been free and vital. The church is a huge influence on the values of the culture. The church works to help the state when the state is right and calls the state to righteousness when the state is wrong. This is what I mean when I say something like the church is the soul of the system, sort of metaphorically the conscience of the society. But still, the Iranian student and others are likely to say to me, well, why not just leave out the church, which you insist is so important to culture? Why can't we just have the freedom and democracy and ignore the rest? Fine, it's true, the faith may have helped us reach this point, but why do we need it now? We've evolved socially and politically. I'll spend most of the next lecture dealing with that question. For now, I'll end this one by invoking Elton Trueblood's magnificent metaphor of the cut flower civilization. A flower grows and becomes beautiful because it is rooted in the ground where it can access the things it needs to live, like nutrition and water. The roots are life. If you cut the flower at its stem and put it in a vase, it will remain beautiful for a time, but soon the process of death and decay will set in. What was beautiful will be lost. Our civilization is like the flower. It did not arrive fully formed and beautiful. It wasn't just kind of sort of gift-wrapped for us all done. It grew and developed over time in response to certain events, certain stimuli, and in connection with a source. The things that we value in our civilization also grew and developed in response to certain events and with connection to a source, which in the West has largely been the Bible and the church. If we separate ourselves from that source and simply declare ourselves to be appreciators of things like freedom and democracy, then a question arises, well, why do we believe in those things and not in others? What were the reasons that we came to believe in those things in the first place? If we no longer believe those reasons to be valid, then are the concepts we embraced valid? Civilization, especially our kind of civilization, is far more vulnerable than we would like to believe, especially if we turn our backs on God. Thank you.
We want to take a few minutes now and have time for questions. Please come to the microphone if you have a question.
Hi. I'm tall. From your example of the cut flower, mm-hmm. You're saying Christianity is the root that helps us grow our democracy and our freedom.
I think it's kind of a source that has inspired so many of these things, yes.
And so in the recent years if you look at my generation, they just hate God. All generations hate God, but we really, really hate God. And
sounds unwise.
We've already cut the flower, you know?
Yeah.
How do we put the flower back together? How do we put it back in the ground?
Well, that's really the question, what is going to make this happen? Do we run a risk of actually being lost? I really wonder. I observe. I have friends in places like Nigeria and Uganda, I sort of see them. They're kind of starting to put together this civilization project, kind of in a way that we've already been through. And I almost wonder if they have a very bright future because of it. America, to me, really, really kind of hangs in the balance. Western Europe, Western Europe probably needs missionaries a lot worse than Africa does right now. Western Europe feels kind of lost to me. But the United States continues to have, I think, a very vital church, a lot of cultural influence. Although it's true that we're losing some things rapidly. I can remember being at the Rutherford Institute around 1999 and John Whitehead telling us at that time, a bunch of young folks, and he said, the gay marriage thing is lost. And we were like, you're crazy. What? And of course, what he said seems to be coming true as that spreads. I think that our only option is to be faithful. We have to find these tasks and go at it. Part of the reason that I do this, people ask me, why are you so focused on secularism? What's the deal there? And what I want to do is to sort of treat secularism the same way university religion departments treat religion, right? They have departments of African American studies that sort of glorify the African American culture. They have feminist studies that glorify women. The religion department does not glorify religion, right? It's very critical. It's hard. It's treated roughly. And I sort of want to be a scholar of secularism, forcing the secular viewpoint to kind of answer for itself, right? And all I can say is that we all have to kind of find our way. We have to find our projects. Where can we make the inroads and work accordingly, right? You just kind of put your shoulder to the wheel and pray to God for the results. Yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you for the lecture. It's very informative and excellent. It's been argued that there's really only three forms of government. There's monarchy, dictatorships, and then like a democracy or republic. And that usually when one fails, it gives way to one of the other two. And so I think we are seeing sort of the falling apart of the democracy slash Republic of America because of just a failure of civil virtue, which is absolutely necessary to the sustaining of a republic slash democracy. And so I guess my question is, what do you see happening to America? I mean, I see it seems like there is a pattern where there is more of a giving way to despotism, to greater government control, to greater invasiveness of the government due to a loss of the things that make democracy possible.
Yeah.
And so which direction do you see America going, and what could possibly happen to stop it from heading that direction?
Well, as a person who has studied the law, one of the things I talked about in this lecture was limited government, limiting power, right? Not, you know, sort of the Christian insight in America not being to say, well, they have the power and we want the power, right? It's not about that. It's not just changing the chairs on who has the power. The real issue is how much power, right? And the Christian insight is, hey, human beings are sinful, so maybe it would be a good idea to limit the amount of power, right? Which I think is makes tremendous sense, and has been very successful for this country. What I think has happened, particularly if you look at development in constitutional law over kind of the history of the republic, is that we're losing that sense that our federal government is a government of limited power, right? Originally it was said that the government of kings is kind of a government of inherent authority, right? They can do what they want. But that the American government was different because it was a government of delegated powers that specifically listed these are the things this government can do. And through a variety of ways, one being the Interstate Commerce Clause, the government has kind of found a way to extend its fingers into everything. And it's sort of that progressive impulse that there's no problem that government power can't solve. And they very much resist that idea that power should be limited. And so I think that's a real danger in the way we're going. Any other questions? Here we go.
I just have a question about, we talk a lot about America being the change of government to bring in freedom, democracy, Christianity, but how do we reconcile the idea that, you know, like Romans teaches us that God's given the authority of the government, and how do we have the right to, you know, as the American Revolution did, to rebel against their government? And like, how do we reconcile the concept of protecting people and freedom and that such, and then moving on to obeying the government that's established?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's something you said right at the beginning that really caught me. First of all, about the revolution. There's interesting debate several years ago as to whether it was actually Christian of us to engage in the revolution. And, we need to bring in some historians to debate that in the specific circumstances. But there's definitely a tension there, okay? I guess my primary answer to you would be that, yes, it's clear we're supposed to obey the king or the authorities. They wield the sword for our good. But I think that there's also a sense that we're not supposed to just lay down, right? I mean, there is a sense of a higher good, a higher moral order, God's moral order that exists above that, and that we owe our primary allegiance to that, and not to some king or some bureaucrat or whatever else. So I think you can still and the other side of it is this. I think about this often. In the United States, we don't have a king, right? We the people, we effectively wield that power. And so if we choose to limit that power, then how would we be running aground of the Bible, right? We ourselves are choosing to limit the power, and we in fact wield the sovereignty in this nation. So I would say we're not actually going against any sort of biblical edict there. Sure. Hello.
Hey. In reading of Schaeffer's A Christian Manifesto, he talks about the preaching movement that preceded the American Revolution and spurring that on. What role do you see in the church today in trying to preserve this liberty?
Well, I mean, just the biggest thing is that I think that a vital church, that the greatest weapon that we have kind of in preserving our freedom is that we do believe that there are institutions other than the state that kind of deserve some of our allegiance, that speak for certain values that the state may not speak for. The church is a big one. In the next lecture, I'm going to talk about that, kind of this idea of what totalitarians want to do is they want to have only two entities in the society, which is the state and the individual, right? Nothing in between. And the state must be constantly free to act upon the individual. But the church has a role to stand in between, right? The church has a role. The church can make a credible case to stand for an independent source of moral authority that the state doesn't necessarily have. And so that the church, I think you should just continue to reinforce the idea that the church should call the state to righteousness. Yes, we need to constantly be about the work of saving souls, but also that social, that political witness is very important. In fact, the third lecture, the entire issue in the third lecture is kind of against what I call Christian secularism, because I think a lot of Christians believe that we should only kind of be involved in preaching for salvation of souls and leave out the issue of a social witness or kind of speaking prophetically to the state, things like that. They need to raise these microphones. Everybody's tall.
Thank you for the lecture, by the way.
Sure.
Do you think that as a democracy and truly establishing freedom within a democracy, that we necessarily have to have a bias toward Christianity as opposed to, you know, Islam or something? You know, I have to think about, you know, the mosque being built next to Ground Zero. You know, if that was supposed to be a church being built there, I don't think most of us would have a problem with that. And given, of course, recent events, you know, we all have a problem with the mosque, but that really got to me thinking about our religious freedoms.
Yes.
You know, do we have to have a Christian bias?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I've been asked about that a lot lately. And, you know, there's a real tension there. On the one hand, we have to preserve our religious liberty. The religious liberty is the first liberty listed in the Bill of Rights. It's hugely important to a free society. We absolutely must maintain that. And some people would say that that by upholding, by giving a real priority to that right, that we will teach the Muslim world, right? That we will show them kind of our enlightened view of religious liberty, and they will benefit from that lesson. What complicates all this is Islam. Right? Because I'm not sure that they would receive the message that way. I'm not sure if what they won't hear if we say, sure, build the mosque there, is, you know, we're spiritually spent and we don't know what we believe in anymore. Just do what you do what you will. That's the concern I have, is kind of what message will we send. I think that this is one of those prudential situations where we really do need to kind of examine the situation. What are the motives of these people? You know, what are they trying to accomplish? Who's giving money to it? Because you don't want to allow some kind of flag of conquest to be planted near the site. That would be terrible and would set religious freedom back. Now, as to this question about is there any Christian priority, I think that's something I think about a lot. Because you can't just sort of act like America shows up and the Christianity is extraneous to it, right? Like the Christianity is somehow alien to the character of America. It's all meshed up in there, right? America is, I mean, Christianity is part of American culture. And so when people complain about things like, I don't know, the Ten Commandments or other monuments or memorials. I sort of think that there's something kind of uncivil about that complaint. And what I mean is it seems to me like it's sort of like if I were to travel to Ireland and then were to complain, you know, why is all this Irish crap everywhere? You know, it's kind of like that. Hello.
Thank you for the lectures.
Yes, sir.
My question is kind of secondary to the whole thing, but in my study of the American Revolutionary period, it seems to indicate more to me that the sources say that the founders saw people as being virtuous.
Yes.
I believe that
very much.
The early Americans, such as like Edwards and things like that, the Puritans, you said that they had a Calvinistic view of man.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems that by the time of the Constitution and the founders, that had kind of faded out. And you have more of an Enlightenment idea, and people have become virtuous. And like for instance, Royster, Charles mm-hmm. Royster in Revolutionary Period of War, he argues that idea that people were virtuous kind of moved the people to fight against England because they saw that they were not virtuous,
mm-hmm.
but they could be virtuous and still be that way. Does that make sense?
Well, what you said there at the end is kind of where I connect. I think that one of the common convictions about the founding was that freedom and virtue are tied together, right? And I mean, and you can see that just in dealing with children. If any of you have children, I have an 8-year-old named Andrew, okay? And Andrew, a number of times, will kind of flip out and get crazy. And I'll say, Andrew, you can control yourself or I can control you, right? So he can make the choice. And the American founders believe there's a relationship between freedom and virtue, right? If the people will be virtuous, if they will govern themselves, govern their own passions, their appetites, then they can be free, right? And they thought that was necessary for having the kind of government that we have. And I think that's clearly true. And part of why many of them supported the idea of kind of church establishments and things like that is that they thought the church would help people to be virtuous. So I guess I would say I don't think they necessarily viewed people as naturally virtuous, but that they thought people could be virtuous and that there were things you could do as a society to encourage that, you know, education, the church, things like that, to sort of make people be fit for freedom. But this idea about limiting power, the difference is that if you ever read Antigone, the king Creon, he says you never really know a man until he has government and law in his hand, right? And that's sort of what the founders recognize is that you never really know somebody until they get power, and we need to act to restrain them because we realize that human beings are sinful and they could put their power to bad use.
Thank you.
Sure thing. Thank you.